Welcome to Emotionally Correct, a hilarious DEIA podcast with Kelton and Charisse from IDEA.
Hi. What's up?
What's up, yo?
I feel cranky today.
Do you?
Cranky. Yeah. I think the reality of life is, you know, this pending administration change. Sometimes I say to people, like, you don't understand, this is my local news. You know, like if you live in Boise, maybe they talk about the crops, or maybe they talk about how great it is to live so close to the West Coast in Canada. I don't know what they talk about on the local news, but national news is our local news here in DC. So it's kind of a strange, like, it feels like you never get away from the national news, even in even in your local news.
Do you think that's the case? Do you think that we are unique in the climate that we live in terms of it being local and constant?
I mean, I think it's an interesting feeling. Like, our city changes every 4 years when the administration changes. At least that's what it's felt like to me over the 30 years I've lived here, is that the change in administration, not so much if you had go from one Republican to another or one Democrat to another, but when you change parties as a result of the election, when the election causes a change in party in the White House, it does feel a little bit to me like the atmosphere of the city changes.
That's very interesting. And I think this might be something that we could look at, like, who in the populace locally feels this? Because I grew up in DC and I've never felt that.
You don't feel like the city changes for you?
No.
Huh.
Feels absolutely the same. And I think about my entire life and I've never felt the difference in the city. There are some things.
It could be our lines of work too, right? Like, I've worked mainly in, like, national policy spaces around criminal legal stuff. And so, like, when I worked at the Justice Department, when the administration changed, all the bosses changed.
That could be something. Yeah.
I think the atmosphere of my colleagues in other nonprofit spaces changes. The atmosphere around us changes. The impact, you know, it's funny. I think that, you know, my mom sent me a text saying, like, oh, you've been so quiet. And I'm thinking, yeah, because what just happened deeply impacts a lot of things I care about. And so I'm still trying to adjust. And in my line of work in the nonprofit space, it's been all over people's LinkedIn pages and Facebook posts and all the things about, like, well, now what? You know, now what? A lot of things people care about get impacted by the atmosphere in philanthropy, because that's where a lot of us go for funding. Gets certainly impacted by what the Justice Department is willing to fund. That gets impacted by Congress, maybe more so than the administration. But we're on track right now to have one party control all major bodies of government. So.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you use kind of the broad term nonprofit. I guess it really depends on what space within the nonprofit you're in. And yes, you know, I've been in nonprofit a long time also, from the human services side. And certainly there were times when we had change in government that there was talk about, you know, what did it mean for shifts in the structures, you know, and the money flow. particularly when I was nonprofit in DC. But I never, you know, and I would, you know, because I was part of executive teams, I would sit in on meetings and I'd hear them, but I never really saw anything change in our delivery of services. Never seemed to get any tighter. But here's the thing, there never seemed to be a wider blow of capital when Democrats were in. So I guess you hear this a lot. And I guess the reason why I asked the question, and it was interesting when you made the statement, because we hear this inside outside the Beltway stuff all the time. And outside of those like yourself who worked in an area of nonprofit that was directly lined with who's in office, I don't know if you have to go as far as Boise for people to be like, well, this doesn't affect me every day.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I hear that. Well, this is supposed to be a hilarious podcast, and I do not feel very hilarious today. But that said, we talked about the election on our last podcast. It's only 2 days after the election. Now here we are.
Is it only 2 days?
Last week when we recorded, it was only a couple days. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were saying today was only 2 days. I'm like, damn, it feels longer.
Yeah. No, it's almost a week now. But so we can talk about the election more, what's happening around all of that since then, or we can just move on to other topics. How are you feeling?
I mean, I can just go with the flow. I had an interesting interaction last evening with some folk, some very influential people in an area of our government I don't even want to like say. Right. But these individuals are at the top of what they do. And they were scared.
White folks, black folks, brown
white
folks.
White folks. At the very top, at the pinnacle of what they do. And they were scared. And yes, they were scared that they were going to end up working for Elon, right? Mm-hmm. And when you look at the face of things and really how he's positioned himself, and when you understand the sway he already holds, particularly in the aerospace industry, it was understandable, mm-hmm. you know? So, but here's the thing. So that's that. But what was even more interesting as I sat around this kitchen table, literally, as we like to talk about kitchen tables in politics, I sat around this kitchen table, their two children were expressing the same level of fear. And so what then came to my mind is, do we perpetuate this idea of doom when one party or the other takes office by influencing and telling our children how to think in a time when they are completely oblivious to any change that might occur outside of a change directly in their home or school? And if this is how we're messaging for our children, no wonder we grow up in a world or a world evolves that is so polarized. I mean, these kids were saying things that were pretty difficult to listen to about the incoming administration. And I mean, in language much more harsh than I would use, and it was accepted in the environment that they were in. And so I just started to wonder, what role do we play? What role do I play? What role do others play in forming, shaping, and creating the next world that we'll live in?
Well, I mean, I think kitchen tables are one thing. Most kids get their news from social media, you know, and I don't mean like any old person social media like I'm on, like Facebook, but, you know, my son's 21, so he's not a child, but he reads Reddit, news on Reddit. And so I don't know. How old were these children?
We're talking 8 and 11.
And when you say harsh words, words you wouldn't use, what do you want to say what those words were?
I really don't. I really don't. And it wasn't the words, it was the theme of the words.
Well, why was it, what was it hard to hear? I mean, I'm not saying what were the words, but why was it hard to hear them talk that way?
Because I would not speak that way of anyone who had been elected to come into office in a fair and equal election inside of the United States. I can say I don't like the policy, I'm unhappy, I'm even afraid, but the things I was hearing were way stronger than that.
Well, maybe you're just too polite.
Well, I am polite. I'm very polite. I think that we probably don't give politeness enough weight in our society. However, this is not that. This ain't that. So,
Well, okay,
yeah.
I'm gonna pull a thread from a prior episode of this show.
Red pulling.
Where you were talking about your upbringing and you were talking about some of the colorism in your family.
Yeah.
And we made some side joke about whether or not you were black enough.
What was that, a joke we were making?
Mean,
Because that's a question.
not like a
No,
joke joke,
I
but
understand.
like the conversation. I think it's, it's a, so I'm imagining you sitting around a table full of white folks. You're the only black guy there, only black person.
Yeah,
Yeah.
pretty much. Yes, ma'am. Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is a voluntary space you put yourself in, yes? It's
It's
a
a voluntary
social
space.
space.
It's a social space that I engage in once a month. And it's rare that the topic turns this deeply to politics, but we're in that moment right now. And it is a space that is very liberal. Okay. And everybody kind of sees things the same way. So yeah.
So what's that like for you sitting around with all those white people? I mean, the world is a pretty segregated space. We haven't talked about that at length, but like part of what's true, I think, for a lot of liberal white folks is that just the world is organized in ways that work really hard to keep us all separated. And so desegregating your own life is a really challenging thing to do. And a lot of black folks have said to me, I don't really want to hang out with more white folks. So thank you for doing your work, but like, that doesn't mean we're gonna go to tea.
Yeah.
And then I think there's, you tell me. But is there some suspicion cast upon black folks who spend too much time voluntarily and socially with white folks?
I would say that I can't speak for everything and everyone, but I would say, yeah, I think to a degree, if some black folk were to see how much time I spend in the company of white folk, they might say, what's up? What's up with that? I brought a white friend with me to meet a couple of friends that were in town this past weekend, and two males. And I didn't tell them that, she was white. I didn't tell them. So we just show up, right? Because I don't know.
These are some black friends of yours.
These are black friends of mine from childhood, literally from the third grade, right? All the way through college together. We've known each other like brothers. So they don't know I don't tell them what's happening in my personal life or anything. So I show up and I don't tell them that she's white, right? I don't know if when I attend something with someone who's white, if they announce, that they're bringing a black guy, right? I think that's just weird, right? I like the idea of showing up as a person and just being who I am. So anyway, they were totally fine. There was no change in expression. They welcomed her as if I had walked in with anyone at all. Now, when one of my black childhood female friends entered, it was a clear taking aback in a moment and kind of like, oh wow, right? And kind of, and I could be, this could, I have to be honest that part of this could be my fantasy, right? I have to be honest about that. But there seemed to be a air of suspicion, right, as the conversation continued. When we stood to leave, it seemed that she had worked her way into a more neutral space and actually was much more engaging as we were leaving to this person. So that was interesting. I asked about sitting with white folks. So this group of people I see almost once a month. And when I first went to see them, it felt very warm and very inviting. I could tell they're all very liberal. But they don't have black people in their life, really. They work with some people. I have never been there with some other black folk that showed up and said, hey, how you doing? Right? So I realized that I'm it. I'm it for their intimate circle of interaction. I'm the black guy, right? So for myself, it has taken, I've known them for 2 years almost. It has taken this time for me to actually be at a level of comfort, not because they make me uncomfortable, but because I feel as if I need to be guarded when I enter with white folk that I don't know. And as I begin to build trust, I have to be guarded that I don't come in, too jovial, like this knee slapping, go fetch it, blackface guy, right? Because that's what I feel. I can be, well, I think I can be funny, as this podcast is clearly not proven,
No,
but
it's not. We are failing in our attempt to be hilarious. It's
I
just
can be hilarious. I can joke, and I can make fun of, and I can, But when I meet people, when I meet white folk, it seems to me, well, it doesn't seem to me, it is my position, as it is many educated black people's position, to be as intelligent as I possibly can, to speak as clearly as I can, to laugh when it's appropriate, and to make very appropriate jokes, kind of laughter,
Wait, are you at? Is that like a? Okay, so this is where I
It's
get
code
off.
switching, it's not acting, it's code switching, and this is what we did, black folk do. We code switch.
Of course. Well, women code switch around men all the time. So code
There
switching
you
is
go.
some, yeah, I mean, I don't use that word, but we know how to behave in certain situations where our demographic is not as represented, and we know what would be passable behavior versus not passable behavior. And the things that we, if we were around just other women, we would not tolerate the language around. But in the company of men, in male-dominated spaces, you just sort of like, oh, ha, that's funny. Or you just don't react in a way that draws attention to that you might have been offended or whatever by what was said. Wonder how you sit with all of that.
Therese, how did I sit with it with you and the guy? I mean, this is the same dynamic that was
So it is the
created.
same dynamic. I mean, what you're referring to is the fact that when we became friends, you are my that you hung out with some of my friends, the majority of which, I mean, COVID is a weird time, but the majority of which were white.
Well, I think you had a vastly more diverse relationships in your circle of friends. The group that was closest to you that I spent the most time with were all white. And I mean, it's interesting. No, it's interesting now that you brought this up. I warmed up faster with your friends because of you because I knew how you were. I knew the things that you championed. I knew those things. So I think that I was looser in that journey to being who I am around your friends than I have been in this one.
Do you think, yeah, I mean, so there's a term many people will recognize, intersectionality, from Kimberly Crenshaw, that just talks about the importance of understanding all the series of identities people bring with them into spaces. And the original notion of that concept was that when you have two or more intersecting identities that are marginalized, that build upon each other. So there's a greater level of discrimination or a greater level of impact of those identities. So Black and female as two marginalized identities, just sort of one more than Black and male. And then you add on social status, orientation, gender, ability versus disability, all the things. Most of the white folks, there are white folks who will argue that if they have another margin, even if they're white and they have another, if they have some marginalized identity, so white men who are gay are more likely to believe that they understand marginalization. I'm not here to judge or evaluate where people sit vis-a-vis their identities and the marginalization. We also try really hard not to play the marginalization Olympics, right? Where one person, but you also have to acknowledge the longstanding issues around race that have been more visible than orientation over 400 years. Nonetheless, I'm off on a tangent. Yes, you hung out with white folks that I knew. You could assume that I wouldn't hang out with white folks who believed something really contrary to what...
Totally assume that from the very jump of the ball.
Yeah. And yet I do. I mean, I think I do have friends who believe very differently than I believe. How close those friends are to me versus the people I spend more of my time with. People often talk about that as like, oh, you're fighting over politics, but it's really hard. It doesn't, you know, the political is personal, right? And so if someone's political beliefs result in pain for people I care about, that's hard. It's really hard to stay as close to those people as other people. But I'm curious about sort of, do you feel like you got all the way? I don't know. What do you have only one way of being? When you say you were being yourself.
No, I don't have only one way of being. And even with my own, I mean, it's so nuanced, right? I mean, even within a community of Black folk that I don't know, I'm still going to present in a more guarded manner. I think that's just normal for anybody. However, it's a good question to ask me, because now that you say that, I'm thinking, with this particular group that I'm talking about, have I been as close to what I would identify or say is my real self? And I would say, yeah. I say right now, yeah, yeah. But it's taken me a while. I was about to say it's not about trust. I think, well, yeah, part of it is about trust. There's another element here, right? And there's an important part of the kitchen table with people who don't look like us or even believe the same way. But I'll say look like us, because we all kind of believe the same thing. We look differently. I told a story last night. And I've told you the story, and you know, the story about the Confederate flags during George Floyd. I was on the bike ride, and I go to the Confederate Memorial that's in Southern Maryland, just outside of Point Lookout. And I'm shocked that there's this obelisk and these, and maybe like 40 or 50, I think they're 50 Confederate flags around this thing. And I'm riding past it, getting ready to turn the last 2 miles into the park. And I'm like, how in the world does that exist? I mean, we are marching in the streets. There are police officers and armed people. Trump is out front with the Bible. We got crazy stuff happening across the United States. And I'm cycling here in rural Maryland, and there is a complete memorial to which appears to me to be the Confederacy. And the conversation that was born from that was a conversation that I sat down and talked to folk who the curator of this monument. It was a private monument, and I sat and talked with her and her husband and two Iraq vets that came up. We were so far apart in our political belief structures, and yet we sat and we spoke, and we found a common thread within the humanity of us. And what came out of that was this woman's son had been on heroin for a long time. And because we sat and talked long enough, she became aware that I worked in addiction and was, and my sole goal and my job in addiction was to get people into treatment. And so I was able to help her. Why did I tell that whole thing? Because as I sat with my friends last night, one of the things that I realized as I told that story, I saw the tears well up in their eyes. And I realized that you can kind of from an intellectual space be liberal and understand the struggle from some place, some very, theoretical place. But if you don't have people that sit at your kitchen table who actually can relate the experience directly to you from their own lived life, right? You don't really feel the weight of it, right? It's tragic to see the photographs of a knee on the neck of another human being, regardless of who that human being is, and watching that person die. That is horrible, but that is through our television. That is a million miles away. It is a two-dimensional figure that impacts us at some deep level. When we are sitting with someone who is speaking from their heart and telling a story, it's a different thing. And I think the tears were not tears of pity about me. I think it was, damn. How does someone sit with someone who is that far from you, that hates you, and have a conversation? And I saw the humanity in their eyes as I spoke, and they started to have tears well up. And I think I know Black people will say we don't have no responsibility, but I think that is part. I see it as part of my responsibility.
What?
I really do. Sitting with people who don't think the same or
Oh,
don't
not
look
yet.
the same.
Well, yeah, but that's because we're the kind of people. I mean, this, yes. But not everybody feels that way. And sometimes we feel that way. And what am I trying to say? I mean, part of this is in the work that we try to do. I think not everybody has the emotional bandwidth to sit with that stuff, right? You have to have done some self-work to be able to sit with people, hear them say things that you feel like on their face you totally disagree with, and maybe not even on their face, maybe completely and utterly, and through the fabric of all of it, you completely disagree with. But you have to try to think with them about why they feel that way. I think that's hard for a lot of people. I don't even know that I'm good at it now, but I haven't always even cared to do it. Because it sometimes feels like the gap is so large. The other thing that it feels like is sometimes it feels there are some people who feel as if that is sort of consorting with the enemy,
Yes.
that like if you are willing to sit and talk to people. So you know as well as anyone, one of my closest friends is a trans woman, and I think sometimes when people know who people are, know that you have close relationships with people of different identities, they may be less likely to say things in front of you, right? So here's one of my best friends, Kelton. He's a black guy. People are less likely to say things to me about black folks. One of my best friends is a trans woman. Maybe people are less likely to be honest with me about how they feel. What I hope they will do is ask me a lot of questions, right? Like what I want to be is a resource for under sort of bridging those conversations. Because yeah, I don't think it's my friend's job to educate everyone on the planet about trans issues. And all I know for myself is that I don't want her to get shoved in front of a subway, that I don't want her to get attacked on her way home from work, that I don't want her gender affirming care to be taken away. And I just, I want for her what I want for anybody in my life, which is just the ability and the agency to thrive in whatever it is they love to do. But sometimes I think that if I am willing to sit down and talk to some folks who are anti-trans, that's sort of, there's a loyal, like, am I violating some sense of loyalty to my friend? And yet I should be the person talking to people who are interested in asking me questions or who are anti-trans. But for you to do it directly, there's a conversation about what emotional labor that is, right, for Black folks and whether or not you should have to do it. I wonder what gets missed when people, I get it. I get the labor and I get how triggering it is and I get how all the things. And so I'm happy to be somebody who steps in those spaces with white people and talks to white people about race. Totally happy to do that. And there's something still much more powerful about proximity. So I feel like I've learned so much by being able to have dialogue with you, whether or not people consider you black enough because
Yeah.
you hang around with white people, right? That's not something for me to say or for me to question. It's funny, people don't ask if I'm like I'm willing to hang out with, I'm willing to talk to men about misogyny. Does that make me not female enough?
You're definitely not female enough. I think that's definitely a
Well,
thing.
clearly, if I was female, if I were female enough, I'd have like a long bob. I'd be
Oh,
old.
would you? Would you? And if I was black enough, I'd have an afro? Really? What?
Well, you'd have an afro if you could grow your hair, but it's past that time.
Oh, I'd have a Jesus ponytail. Thank you very much.
Is that right?
That's my fantasy since I was a little kid. I'd grow my hair long and I'd pull it back in a ponytail and
When
yeah.
was that your fan? You've got weird fantasies, man.
I have dreams of having lots of hair blowing like Jesus. I don't know, since I was a kid, it's been a thing. And I couldn't grow an afro when I was a kid, so I never had one. Mine was about this big. My brothers and sisters were like out here, like Angela Davis. I was,
Hey, I don't want to get off on this
would say
tangent,
to me, you're just not black enough. That's what they would say to me.
I don't want to get off on this tangent, but was the Jesus represented in your religious upbringings a what was white guy?
Of course he was white. Isn't Jesus white? Jesus is white.
Jesus was not white. Okay, let's just move on.
He's black now. In our 4 years of our churches, he's black now. But he was a white guy growing up.
Yeah, he had yeah the flowing hair, the Fabio kind of look.
But
What do you think? What do you think it means to be black enough?
I just want to
Oh,
address something really
you want to do something different? Go ahead.
No. I want to talk about that. No, I just want to say when I because I said I felt it was my responsibility. I don't feel it's my responsibility in every moment of every conversation. In fact, with this group, we've had very few times that we've spoke of race, and I don't try to force the conversation. I let things flow. But when it turns to that, I think that's where my responsibility. I feel responsible for speaking in a way that actually tells my story of blackness. I can't tell anybody else's, right? It's related to a lot of people that are from my community, but my story of blackness. Black enough. Yeah, you know, sometimes when I hear people, particularly Black folk that are in the struggle, right? They're in the struggle. The work that we do, okay? And I hear Black folk in the work that we do, and they have all the language and they've read everything, and you know, all the heavy hitters and writers within this genre of literature that relates to and of course in the educational space, right? In academia. You know, there's heavy stuff out there, right? People did research, and you know, there's a lot of stuff. And I listen to them talk, and I think, oh my God, if I say what I think, they're gonna be like, you have no idea, you non-Black man, right? And this is the problem with our community, because we don't know. And I'm like, what? And what I've struggled with, and what I struggle with in being Black enough, is by saying my lived experience and the way that I see things from my own perspective carries a lot of value and meaning, right? And I believe that it does, but in many circles, not so much today. I growing up in my 20s, and when I would go to those dinner parties I talked about in our first episode, and I would say, I'm not going to check the box. I'm not checking the box, right? And you know, and I was having this conversation just the other day. When they put the boxes there, right? They put white, Black, non-Black, Hispanic. What else is there? Native American. Well, that wasn't always there either. And then they put in other, because they were like, well, you want to claim none of these, you can claim other. And who's going to claim other than non-white people? So they could have just had white people and other. You know they're not white. They put other. It was the dumbest box in the world.
That, you know what, I'm going to just say, ironically, so when I did my research for my dissertation, I had all the categories of race you could select from the, you know, as defined by the US Census. And I had an other box. I mean, I thought I was exhaustive in the list of things, right? Including you could be of mixed race, like all the things. And I had an other box. And there were maybe out of the 100 people, well, there's like 150 people who took my survey. Like two or three people checked the other box, and I was like, huh, wonder what I missed. So I dug into the data, and they're like, German, Irish, Italian. Now, I do not believe these are people currently living in Germany, Ireland, or Italy, nor do I believe that these are people without US citizenship because. You had to be a lawyer licensed to practice law in the United States to take my damn survey. But isn't that fascinating? So, white people, I'm sorry, but Germans, Italians, and Irish, we are by census categorized as white, non-Hispanic. But I wondered, so it's interesting because some folks would say, well, those are white people who are trying to distance themselves from whiteness by claiming they do not, well, you know how I feel about the word Caucasian, can't stand the word Caucasian, but they don't want to be classified in that way, white or Caucasian. So they picked other and they said, no, I'm Italian. Seems a little, I mean, I don't know the motivations for them doing it. I know what people would say about those people. I know what other white people would say. Some white people would say, well, that's right. I shouldn't be defined by, I want to make my own definition of myself. I have to feel like a bunch of a bunch of folks of color might say, well, get the fuck out of here. Irish, Italian, German. You're white.
I don't even know what it means for a person who is white to say, I don't want to be defined by a color. Okay, you're not defined by a color, you're Irish. And you walk down the streets of New York, you are white. I say I don't want to be defined by a color, and I'm trapped in the same way. I still am defined by a color because of the way I look. And so I check other and I walk in, and the person already knows I'm going to be a person of color, right? Because I checked other. They may not know if I'm going to be black or brown, but they know I'm going to be something else. I can't escape it, right? So I think that the people who pushed against me and said I wasn't black enough were really, I feel like, saying to me in that moment, you're a fool because you can't not be black. So by your saying you're not going to wear that label, it doesn't change anything for you. And this is where I depart from some people, because I believe that labeling does have an impact on how you think, breathe, see, and how you feel about yourself. And I believe it starts with liberating yourself from, and I think this is why it's beautiful that people have decided, humans have decided, that they want to remove the binary gender labels and say, I'm other things. Because they represent more of what I feel. They represent more of how I live my life. And so I want to be that. I didn't want to be.
Well, that's
black.
Just a really, it's kind of a shitty example, because who knows what the next 4 years will bring, right?
It's a shitty example because we don't know what the next 4 years.
Yeah, because in a space where kids now, children and their parents may not be able to avail themselves of gender confirming healthcare, then, I mean, I do think that the pushback on self-identifying a gender is pretty loud. We've now left that space a little, it seems, in the queer community, right? In the, that would be like a better example, which is now you're not just either lesbian or gay versus straight. There's like 14 different things you could self-identify as. But we've gotten more used to that or comfortable with that. Not so much in the, I don't really think so much in the gender space.
Okay.
But,
I'll accept that.
But you and I had this, we sort of made that joke that, like, why do people who don't identify as heterosexual get to pick from among 15 different labels? But you or I don't get to pick from among whatever labels we want. But other people would say, well, that's just because we have 400 years of history centered around laws that say, you know, one drop.
And, you know, I think that when I say things like, I don't want to be identified as black, people think it means I don't want to identify with that 400 years or the struggle or all that.
Or somehow you're being disrespectful to the ancestors.
Yeah. But we moved through at least four terms that we accepted as a community. And because we moved to those different labels, everyone didn't accept them. I remember my grandmother was like, I'm not calling myself black. She was comfortable with colored or even Negro, but she wasn't going to be black. She wasn't going to be African American. Well, that came much later.
Wait, did she ever say why she didn't want to be identified as black?
Well, my grandmother and early on with my parents, they shifted into blackness. But when black first came on as a term, King pushed back on it. And it was like, okay, it carries all of the negative connotations of the word, and yet we're going to put it on and we're going to say this is good. And so it was difficult for some people at that point to make that switch. Right, to embrace this idea of being black and proud, they seem to be, you know, contraindicating to one another. I can't be
Wait,
black.
Do you know who decided you would now be called black as a community? Where did that word come from?
Well, I'm going to say where it got its power was during the Panther movement and during the period of time with X, because King and X sat down to have that conversation, right, between about black and colored. And I have no problem with the word today. I'm black and I'm proud, right? However, just like I didn't announce that my friend was white, do I need to announce that here comes a black man, right? So, if I'm going to be introduced to as a speaker, does my race come up as part of my introduction? If I'm filling out an application, either for employment or for some type of association, which I did in the Triathlete Association that we both belong to. I don't know if we belong to the same one, but then when they were asking for members to work in their structure, I said yes, and I wanted to work in the diversity and equity area, which they had, and they asked me what race I was. Now, I understand they want to be diversified. I know that's what they're striving for, but I didn't want to check a box. I didn't want to check the box. It's a dilemma that does it because I'm looking at your face and I see your face. So it's a dilemma without an answer. I get it. I get why the box needed to be checked. I just don't want to check it. But it's the world we live
Listen,
in.
you don't have to check it if you don't want to. As you've said though, self-identification bumps up against how people view you. And in the gender space, they say, try to be careful not to misgender someone, right? Misgendering. So calling someone by pronouns or referring to them in a way that implies a gender that they don't self-identify as. And so I just think it would be, I wonder what that would be like if you walked around and like anytime said, oh, as a Black man, you'd be like, I'm not Black. And I just wonder, what would people's reaction be? It would
Or
be actually really fun, like for 1 week, anytime anyone ever referred to you as Black, if you're like, I'm not Black.
and in groups of people where we're discussing things like the change in our government right now, if I said things like, I wonder what Black people are feeling. It'd be really interesting to talk to a Black person and find out how they're seeing this. Right?
People would think you were being funny. They would think you're being ridiculous.
Or if I said to other Black people, no, that actually doesn't sound so crazy because they would, if I just said to somebody, hey, as a Black man, how do you see it? They wouldn't understand that I was saying I wasn't Black. Yeah. But if I was in a company of white folk and said it, they'd be like, what?
Yeah, when you and I first became friendly, there were some Black folks who said to me that your ease of association
Come on, this is what I want to know.
with white folks means you got some self-hatred going on.
God, yes. When you told me that, it made me so fucking angry. Oh, can I say fucking on the
Yeah,
podcast?
that's fine.
Yes. Okay. I became so angry when you told me that.
I know. Why? What would made you angry about that?
Because why do I have to hate myself to love someone else? I mean, you are an amazing human being, right? You are wrapped in this person who you are, the way you look. But you as a human being are an amazing person. You could be orange or green. It wouldn't have mattered. You
Sometimes if
know,
I eat too many carrots, I get a little orange.
Which I find phenomenal. If we were blind, so when I was 17, 16, 17, I worked at the Library of Congress Division for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, which you can't see anymore, but that was the title of it then. And what I came to realize in working there, because I would say probably 80% of the employees were visually impaired, was that it didn't matter. The people who I worked with, and I'm a fledgling, right? I'm just a kid, doing the grunt stuff. But I was treated the same way by everybody in the building because they couldn't see me, right? And so this idea of truly being blind and having to assess a person based on other attributes and elements of their character is a really powerful thing. And that I can do some of that, I won't say to that degree, but some of that with my eyes wide open. Why does that make me a self-hater?
Listen, I don't know. This is not my area of expertise. I just know that the folks who said that to me are not, you know, it's not the it has come up in multiple spaces. I told you about the workshop I went to at the White Privilege Conference. If folks don't know about the White Privilege Conference, they should look that up on the internet. It's been going on for like 25, 26 years. I think we just had that was just the 25th. No, it is not a place where you go to get more white privilege.
I thought it was. I was like,
I
can I
know.
attend? Maybe I
You're
get
like,
some of
oh,
that white,
what are you
can
getting
buy
over
some of
there?
that white
Yeah,
privilege.
it's where we all just sit and like pat each other on the back for being able to go into stores and not get followed, to survive interactions with police officers.
You guys actually set up like box stores that you don't get followed in.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. We role play interactions with police officers. So no, the White Privilege Conference is a place where, you know, you go to, it's really a DEIA conference. It's about unpacking privilege and about working on racial equity. But I went to a workshop put on by a guy who wrote a book. I'll make sure that when we legitimately put this podcast out, that it's underneath the podcast. But it was called The 400-Year Holocaust. And one of his workshops was on, I'm now I have to just look it up because it's going to drive me nuts. And I think it's also fun. You know, every time you touch your screen, we see only the palm of your hand for like a second. It's great. You should
Sorry,
keep that
folks.
up. You should keep that up. It's fun. It's fun just to
Well, I think I
see.
was touching the wrong side of the screen. If I touch over here, you don't see my palm. I was touching from the camera side. Okay, I'm sorry. This podcast stuff is new to me.
So one of the workshops that this author put on was around really tracing the longstanding history of the legalization of rape and sexual assault, basically because slaves weren't considered humans, they were considered property, and so you couldn't actually be arrested or charged with a crime, a sexual crime against a female because they were considered property. But there was a long-standing theme through the book and in this workshop around, therefore, given the history of slave owners raping and impregnating slaves to grow their number of slaves, and the complicity, that's probably not even the right word. That just made me sound smart, but probably not to people who know that's not even really a word. But maybe it is a word now. I just sound dumb for even not saying it's a word. But the fact that white women stood by and watched their white husbands, you know, do the thing. And also, you know, if you don't watch The Handmaid's Tale, in that show, part of the rape ceremony of the handmaids involves the wives holding down the women. Oh, am I boring you? Just kidding. He yawned for people who couldn't see him. Apparently, I'm boring the hell out of him during this.
No. It's just a lack of sleep. I want to watch The Handmaid's
No,
Tale.
it's really disturbing, but the ritual involves white women women holding down the handmaids while the husbands attempt impregnation. And so all of that, the theme of what I'm bringing up is the idea that therefore black men and white women should not date. That somehow we could be friends, but we're not ever really going to be real friends, right? Can't really be real friends with a white person. But that, or with a black person, because they won't ever fully trust you, but that interracial dating is an abomination for reasons black folks would say, or this at least guy said, is that it tends to, then you're ignoring the whole history of basically rape. And, you know, that's not to say that the rape didn't go the other way, too. I mean, there are stories in his book around white women who took a liking to some strapping slave who was in the house, who was probably a better lover than their husband. And so it has this complicated history, right?
Yeah.
Violent, horrible, complicated history. And some folks would say that if you date across racial lines, you are being disrespectful to that history. Kelton, your thoughts on that?
So, as someone who has dated across racial lines quite a bit, starting right around high school, and listening to and understanding the dynamic that you're describing, and we talk about constellation of lives. I mean, I wouldn't look at someone who told me that and say you're ridiculous, right? I think that there can be an argument made for that. And I believe that there are probably, some people are drawn to interracial dating because it's taboo, right? That's the energy that drives them to it. If that's the energy that drives you to it, I'm not going to say that's right or wrong, but I think you need to be at least aware of it. Do you know what it is you're looking for or what it is you have found in a person who is not from your same racial makeup? For me, who, I've done a lot of work emotionally, and when I find someone who has those qualities, they don't have to have all of them, but has those qualities that I find valuable. Where I find that is where I find that. So if it's in a and look, I was married to two women of color, loved them both deeply, had four children of color. It's not like I just ran off to the other side, for my whole life. I have dated across, meaning back and forth across those lines. So it's not as if I've only chosen one way. And so I think it's looking for and being able to recognize those elements that are in someone. And how does a person make me feel? Right? Because a person shares my color doesn't mean they necessarily see me. Right? Doesn't mean that.
You mean the entirety of you?
The entirety of me as a human being, me as a writer, me as a poet, me as someone who is a father who valued the most valuable thing that I've ever done in my life was raise my kids. I mean, if you can see me, that's super important to me. And that hasn't always been based on race. Do fewer white people, white women see me as in my totality? Sure. Absolutely. But I have also had those individuals in my life who could. And they don't claim to understand everything, right? But I don't understand everything about a woman of color because she comes from a whole different place that I come from. Her views and ideas and ideals and values are shaped by something I had nothing to do with. And so just as I have to learn that, so when we date, if you're dating across racial lines, there's more stuff to learn. But if you're honest with one another and say, I don't get that, or how does this feel, or what I'm feeling, yeah, I'm rambling now.
No,
Now
I
I'm
know, and
rambling.
I think I'm gonna wrap this up here. But I do think that I'll make a note about this. I think it's really, I think that understanding whether or not that we speak for everyone, or not that we are selling a product called make friends with people who don't look like you. But I do not personally subscribe to the premise that I have heard others say, which is that black and white people can only get so close in a relationship because they will never understand, because that white person will never fully understand what it is to be black in America. And there's an that because of our nation's history, there is an elevated sense that other differences between people can somehow be bridged, but
Yeah.
that this racial one cannot be bridged.
Yeah.
And you know, the irony of like all of this stuff is like for hundreds of years, we have purported this idea that marriage was between one man and one woman, and that that was a relationship that would stand the test of time. And yet we never have talked about whether or not that could ever be a legitimate relationship, because those people have will never be able to cross that gender line and understand the other person fully, right? In many ways, that that notion that like the best and most authentic relationships are between people who share significant identities should mean that we should have legalized gay marriage a long time ago.
Long time ago.
Long yeah. time ago, right? And so I tend to feel like I would get upset too when people would say to me that my relationship with you, my friendship with you was not genuine, could never be fully a real thing, because I could never understand what it was like to be a Black man in America. But on the other hand, all the racial equity people are telling me it's your job to learn what it is to be Black, for someone to be Black in America. So I was, and I continue to try to learn, and I continue to try to understand not just Blackness, but what it is to be living in my skin as a white person every day, all day long. That's the first thing people of color see when they see me, is a white person. And it just as it bothered you for people to say like, well, if Kelton is dating Black white women, then he just definitely has some problems with his own Blackness. That would piss you off. It pisses me off to think that we are not having some genuine relationship or friendship where we see each other fully. Just because I mean, we see an able-bodied person with a spouse in a wheelchair, and we don't say, what are those two people doing together? She'll never understand what it's like for him to roll around on those wheels all the time.
Right.
But we do this, and I'm sure there are people who will listen to this who will say, yeah, but race is the most violent, and has had the longest history of violence. So you can't compare it to ability or sexual orientation or gender. Race is. Yeah.
And I'll say, okay with that. One of the other things that is a huge divider and does have its roots historically back to, I don't know, further than this country and race, is this concept and idea and practice of religion. And through religion, there has been so much oppression of women, of people of lower economic status, of different belief systems. We look across history and in the crusade of Christianity, you know, people were killed and tortured the whole time. You know, we don't look at coming from two drastically different belief systems as being a barrier or of the history of it. So a Christian marries a Hindu, we don't say, okay, that can never work because the Christians persecuted everybody. So you're absolutely right. Whether it's ability, whether it's race, whether it's economics, whether it's religion, whether it's gender, we're all willing to say you can overcome all of those things. You just can't overcome Black and white.
Yeah. All right. Well, as always, lovely to see you today.
You too.
And
I'm watching the sun kind of disappear, and the concept and idea that we both had of cycling is kind of fading away.
That's all right. That's okay. We should, soon it will be winter and you'll be on an indoor bike. Anyway.
Yeah.
I just want to say I hope that I feel so comfortable sitting in, I always have, right? From the very beginning, you and I have always had a level of comfort with each other that seems to be in contrast to what people should expect our level of comfort to be with each other. And I'm going to argue that your history, maybe a little with, you know, being sort of raised in the church, but maybe more so just in the service oriented nature of your professions, right? Substance use and mental health stuff, really just being around people and understanding and dealing with the variance of humanity and the way people process trauma and all the things that you've seen, which ultimately led you to sort of go to this Gestalt program and And, you know, if anybody has ever done a professional program related to psychology, first you go through therapy. And so, you know, you, I think, are, to me, you are such an example of the kind of thing that IDEA Institute is even talking about, which is that your ability, your social emotional competence, this isn't about being perfect. This isn't to say that you never get triggered. This isn't to say that you never have a bad day or that you're never like, ah, fuck those people. But your level of emotional intelligence, your ability to self-regulate, your ability to be reflective of your own behavior and your own thoughts, your ability to have conversation where you don't make your trauma isn't just like vomited on other people for them to have to process. Like your ability to do all that makes you an incredibly special person. And I think that, and yes, great, I'm also incredibly special, but thank you for laughing.
You actually are, but go ahead.
But you know, I struggle with that sometimes because in any given week, my partner or my family could point to something about my behavior and be like, I don't know, she's on her high horse over there about being all like, you know, whatever. But I just watched her like lose her shit over something little. So I'm not perfect by any means, but I'm always curious and fascinated by my own reactions. And I'm always interested in like after the physical sensation of the anxiety or whatever sort of dissipates, being like, what is that about? That's fascinating.
But that's what makes you special, right? I think
I
that's
think that,
the
but I don't want to call us, I mean, yes, we're special. And these are skills I got taught. These are skills
Oh,
you
absolutely.
got taught. These are
Oh,
not,
absolutely.
and they're skills we keep working on, just like we ride our bikes, right? We had to learn how to ride a bike. We keep learning how to be better on our bikes. And these are skills that I didn't really necessarily learn growing up. I didn't really even know there was a skill set to be developed until I was probably in my 20s. And then it has been an uneven learning and learning and unlearning other things. But I think that this to me is why I got so addicted to this kind of work, because I really believe that our ability to have an authentic cross-racial friendship where we don't ignore race.
No.
In fact, I annoy you because I talk about it all the time.
What gives you the idea you annoy me sometimes?
So, I have a lot of evidence to show that I have annoyed you over time. But
Okay.
I want to demonstrate to people that this is achievable. We are special, but there's nothing special about us. Everybody can do this. It does require self-work, but it now makes it impossible. I mean, you're not the only person of color that I'm friends with, but you're one of the people I'm closer to of color. It makes it almost impossible for me not to see your, not your personal, but sort of your personal. It makes it impossible for me not to consider anti-blackness when I see it. You know, because when I see it, I think about the people I love who are black. And I love you. I love my old colleague Tennille. And I think about like Tennille's raising, you know, I know you got three daughters and a son. She's got two sons. Like I think about your children. I want for them the same things my kid. You know, that I want for my kid. And so it makes it harder. The proximity to you makes it harder for me to just not think about this stuff all the time. The proximity I have to Lisa, my best friend who's trans, makes it hard for me not to see anti-transness and want to say something when someone says a thing, right? And I do think that it's possible. There was a meme this past week about if you don't understand why fill in the blank is mad about the election, then you're not friends with the person of that identity. You just know somebody with that identity. Because if you're friends with a black person, like really friends or friends with a trans person, or friends with an immigrant.
Right. Yeah.
And you don't, you're not confused about why they're concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna add on to something you said. I wanna go back to that word special, and I'm gonna say that you are special and I am special, but our specialness is not something we were born with. It is, no, I'm touching my screen. It is, because I'm turning to my phone. It is something that we choose to do. When you choose to do the work, you choose to be special. And when you choose to open your eyes and to be vulnerable and to say, I'm willing to listen, that's when you become special. It's a choice. You can choose to be special. And in choosing to be special, you choose to begin to make a difference. And so I'm inviting everybody who hears us to say, hey, be special.
Yeah.
Choose to do something different. You know, everybody can do it.
You said your one last thing. I'm going to say my 13 last things. Ready?
Yeah, your last thing was just like 10 minutes, but go ahead.
Well, it was at least 15 minutes ago where I was like, I'm wrapping this up. This isn't charity work either. So like, I'm not interested in being friends with you or Lisa out of some saviorism complex. Now, that's not to say that I was not ingrained with that, and I have to check myself all the time. Am I doing my Wonder Woman thing where I want to swoop in and look good and save the day and be distant from people I think more poorly of, like people who have bias and stereotypes or hatred, you know, white folks like that, or cisgender people who have an opinion about transness, right? It's not to say I don't still have to check myself, but I lost my train of thought. What was I saying? Yeah, I don't do it. I guess I'll have to re-listen to the tape. This is why older people can't do podcasts, because
I don't know who you're talking about.
You remember?
I remember everything. I'm like a trap. I'm steel brained. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know what I was saying.
I was waiting for it.
I know. Wow. It must have been really good. I'm gonna have to lop this part off. All right, my friend. I'm gonna stop this recording now.